What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. But there's another name you might know me by.
Star-Lord.
Who?
Star-Lord, man. Legendary outlaw.
Guys?
Move!
It didn't work for Chris Pratt. It's definitely not going to work for you either, Josh.
All right, just call me Groot then.
That might work. Guardians of the Galaxy may have won this year's box office, but how will it fare as we count down our top 10 films of 2014? Josh, how will it fare?
It's not going to be on mine, but okay. Maybe someone else will have it on their list. This week, it is part one of our top 10 countdown with special guests Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and The Dissolve's Scott Tobias.
Muscle-bound Michael will be shirtless, of course, and Scott is a raccoon.
Plus the winner of this year's Golden Brick Award.
That and more.
I am Groot.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me. Girl, you just don't realize what you do to me.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including
$10 a month donor George from Town and Country, Missouri, $5 a month donor Andy Friedman from Philadelphia, and Silver Club donor David Weiss from Mountain View, California.
A buck a show donation from Stephen in Leeds, West Yorkshire. He says, a long overdue donation. Keep up the good work, and sorry about the Legos argument earlier in the year. He did write in, Josh,
okay,
calling maybe just me out or maybe both of us for calling them Legos.
Yeah, I
not
can't
Lego.
Remember what's correct. Lego is correct,
I think,
right?
Lego is correct,
plural.
But, you know, humble kid growing up in the Midwest, we called them Legos.
You only had one Lego, that's why.
I was dreaming about multiple Legos. Also, want to thank Virginia Tulaney, listening from Austin, Texas. Thank you to all of our monthly donors, and also thank you to everyone who supports the show by rating us on iTunes. It is a great way to help us get more visibility and new listeners. You're listening to Film Spotting, and ready or not, it is time for us to share our top 10 films of 2014. Part one, anyway, picks 10 through 6. And to help us do that, our usual end of year roundtable guests, we start with from the Chicago Tribune and his many regular Film Spotting appearances, Michael Phillips. Michael,
hello.
Thank you for being here.
Hello, Adam. Hello, Josh.
Welcome, Michael.
We also have, of course, Scott Tobias from The Dissolve. Scott, I know you're playing a little bit hurt, but thank you for being here.
Fever. It's the fever game. It's the Jordan fever game. totally comparable. Thanks for having me on.
You're setting expectations awfully high now.
Yeah.
For your picks.
It's really nice, you guys, to devote 14 hours a year to this show coming in. I mean, it means
true,
a lot
yeah.
to us.
It could. Yeah. It could be a while.
It'll basically be like it usually is, but a little more nasally for me.
Okay. We'll
and just that 1 5-minute bathroom break. Right.
that's all you need.
Hour nine.
Well, since it is going to be a long night, let's go ahead and jump right in, or we'll get there in a roundabout sort of way. As usual on these end-of-year shows, we've sprinkled in an assortment of special guest voicemailers. So it's not just our voices. We want to get some other voices in the mix. We've asked them to share their picks for the number one film of the year.
Hello, Film Spotting. I'm Katie Rich, the Hollywood editor of VanityFair.com and co-host of the Fighting in the War Room podcast. And my number one movie of the year is Bennett Miller's Foxcatcher. I think this movie has gone through a lot of criticism of people saying that Steve Carell's performance is really stagey and the nose is fake and the metaphors are obvious. But I think what people miss is that the staginess of John DuPont, this man who Steve Carell plays at the center of this tragic story, is a stagey kind of guy. He's a guy who's self-creating himself. And this movie is about these American myths that we create around athletes, around rich people, around men, and it does such an amazing job of deconstructing all of them. Carell is really great. The intensity of the relationship between Mark Ruffalo and Channing Tatum is really great, and the movie operates on these three points of a triangle where it's this constant battle. And unlike some of the movies from the year like Whiplash or Fury, which are about manliness but really mistreat the women surrounding them, Foxcatcher knows what to do with its women. It casts Vanessa Redgrave as this mother who lords over everything. I think maybe the American metaphors are a little big and bold, but then again, so is America. I think Foxcatcher has a lot to say, says it really well, says it really controlled, is beautiful, and is my number one movie of the year. Thanks for a great year, you guys.
Thank you, Katie, for that pick. Foxcatcher, a film I know, Josh, we certainly had higher expectations for, wish that we loved as much as Katie did.
She's making up for our dismissal of it, I'd
say. She really is.
Yeah.
Some great points there, I think, about the movie. But I was corresponding with Katie, and I want to throw this out to you guys. After she submitted her pick, she said, I almost spent half the voicemail saying I loved all these female-centric movies like Wild and The Babadook and 2 Days, One Night, but then I figured it was wiser not to apologize for embracing the macho. So that actually really corresponded with something I wanted to bring up. As I was looking through my list, I told Katie that that was actually a common theme running through my choices, this theme of men and masculinity in crisis. And so I'm curious, is there anything significant there? Was there something in the air this year with that theme, or was there something else? Was there anything dominant theme-wise for you this year? I guess the better way to phrase it, guys, is there anything you need to apologize for off the bat?
I mean, in terms of my life, my God, 14 hours won't cover it. You
no.
know? But, you know, I like that theme, Adam. I like the idea that it's when I look at even just my top two, you have two extraordinarily different pictures from each other, and yet they both kind of gravitate toward that theme of like what – you know, what does it mean to be, you know, a quote, good man or, you know, grow into a good man or a good human being? I think as we kind of slog through this 21st century, that's a question that is going to run at least all the lives of the four guys at this table.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I had like a theme. I mean, it's very hard to develop a theme out of such a wide variety of films that I see in a given year. And I'm looking at my list, and it's just a motley collection of titles. I can't really make head or tail of it, other than maybe it affirms my auteurist streak, and then sprinkles a couple of new names on there. But as far as some sort of prevailing theme, I'll have to pass on that.
All right. So Scott apologizing for being an auteurist, but that's it. Josh, you?
I think if you look at the lines Katie drew there, I probably have more of a feminine list than a masculine one.
Good.
But there is one title that's so macho, it balances the scales on its own. So
can't wait to get to that pick. Let's go ahead and jump right in then, guys. Michael Phillips, you start us off, your number 10 film of 2014.
Okay. It has not opened here yet. It's going to open at the Siskel sometime next year. Heaven Knows What. Do you guys know?
Yeah, the Safdies.
Did you see this in Toronto?
I did.
Yeah. So this is Josh and Benny Safdie working together. And these are the folks that made Daddy Long Legs. This film was shot in New York, mostly kind of on the down low among street people and heroin addicts. And it's based on the unpublished writings of a now recovering addict, Arielle Holmes, who plays kind of a version of herself here. And this is one of these, non-fiction hybrids, I guess you'd call it, that take you right back to films like On the Bowery from 1956 and Kent McKenzie's The Exiles, which took to the amazing look at kind of the street folk and just the Bunker Hill neighborhood of L.A. in 61. It's just, these are titles that may mean nothing to anybody listening, but I just have to insist that you give this crazy, intense, immersive experience a shot, heaven knows what, and I just think it's my favorite of the films that hasn't yet got a distributor, I don't think
it does. It does.
It does. Does.
It will just come out next year.
Oh, okay.
I can't recall who the distributor is, but I mean, it played in New York, and I think it got enough attention to warrant a distribution.
That's my number 10. And here's the thing. I saw it in a blur in the thick of a film festival, not much sleep. It turned out to be one of the films that worked beautifully on 4 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
Because it is... I've never seen close-ups, at least for a long time anyway, close-ups this close that still retain some sense of proportion or discernment, I guess, and how close the camera is really going to get to some very difficult action to watch, even because you're dealing with a very uncomfortable proximity to some very harsh behavior and circumstances. And it's got the most extraordinary musical score I've heard in a long time. It's just got a lot of things going for it. See this film. If you haven't seen the Safdies, you have to get to know them.
Yeah, it's a very aggressive film. Yeah.
Sounds fascinating, Michael.
Heaven knows
one,
what.
Unfortunately, we have not been able to catch up with yet, but coming to the Siskel, as you said, we'll keep our listeners posted on that with information on our website and throughout the coming year. Scott, you're number 10.
Well, this is also not the most high-profile picture, but I believe it is streaming currently. So, and that's the documentary, The Missing Picture.
Oh, yeah.
This is by Rithi Pan. He did a film a few years ago called S21, The Khmer Rouge Killing Machine, And one of the issues that he has in sort of documenting this Cambodian genocide is that there's not a lot of footage. And there's not a lot of evidence that he can really present in, you know, as a documentarian would, as with like archival footage or things like that. And his solution in S21 was to have actual guards and former, you know, the people that they were tormenting replay their roles. And it's remarkable how they lead normal lives now and they just fall right back into it. It's extremely eerie and disturbing. And in this film, he deals with his own family's internment through the really extraordinary use of these figurines.
Clay figurines, clay, essentially. Right.
Yeah, these very kind of crudely... Not that crudely, actually. They're quite lovely, but these clay figurines that he has in these little sets, and he reenacts them. And there's a kind of like a laying the device bare, where they kind of, you know, the unreality of it is sort of revealed here and there. But it's an extremely inventive and compelling angle into the subject.
One of my real regrets of the year, I think mainly because of that inventiveness, it made me think of a movie that we loved from last year, The Act of Killing,
yeah.
And also a documentary from a few years ago I saw at Sundance dealing with similar subject matter, Enemies of the People,
yeah.
Which is very good as well. So that's one I need to catch up with in short order. Josh, what about you? You're number 10.
This one I know listeners are familiar with because we've talked about it, Under the Skin.
Oh, yeah.
And when we did review it, listeners have heard me talk about my appreciation for this movie as an exploration of body image and its effect on human behavior. So I won't belabor that point any further here. Instead, I want to talk about how this film is, it may be the most complete movie of 2014 when you think of every element of the cinematic art coming together, working seamlessly in conjunction. You've got the screenplay, which is my kind of screenplay. It's a narrative framework for the images, pretty much. That's all you're given here rather than this over-explained plot. You also have that imagery that's immediately gripping while somehow still being tantalizingly ambiguous. You're not quite sure what's going on, what you're seeing, but you know enough. You understand enough. I think about that early sequence of Johansson's alien taking on her new skin. Also, that inky pool that she leads the men into. We really never learn exactly how all of that works, but does it matter in the end? It didn't for me. I understood the fear and I understood the danger that was going on there. I've spoken about Mika Levy's thumping squiggly score and how that just works in conjunction with what else is going on. And then there is Johansson's performance. It's strategically blank, I would say, but also gets to some more layered moments as the movie goes on. And in choosing her, director Jonathan Glazer, he's further emphasizing this idea that Under the Skin is about the practice of judging someone based on their appearances, because really, in so much of Johansson's career, that's what filmmakers or casting directors have done with her. And it hasn't always worked out for the best. Sometimes her performances have been flat in response to that sort of typecasting. Here, though, working in conjunction with the movie's theme, it's really a career performance for her.
Agree with you on everything you said about Under the Skin, and we'll link to this in our show notes if people are curious. One of the members of our Film Spotting Advisory Board, that group of listener volunteers that helps us out with ideas, Melissa Taminga, has a really good theory about the beginning of Under the Skin, and that maybe I think the conventional wisdom about what's happening in terms of the personality or the persona that Scarlett Johansson's character is taking on may be a little bit more complicated than it seems. I really like it.
I'd like to hear that.
So, yeah, we'll share that in the show notes.
That's a truly ambiguous picture in a way that frustrates the hell out of half the people who see it. But
yes, I've heard a lot of frustration over the movie. For the other half of us,
I'm eager to see that a second time, and that's one of the best films that didn't quite make my top 10.
Oh my gosh.
Well,
yeah, we'll have to wait a while.
I figured I was probably stealing some thunder there by putting it at number 10.
Getting Under the Skin out of the way here. As we get to my list here in my number 10, my list that I'm calling, in reference to Katie, the Embracing the Macho Memorial List of picks for 2014. It did occur to me, as we always bemoan how hard it is to form these lists, especially sometimes picking a number one film. Number 10 is really the worst pick, isn't it? Right? Because you're not just ranking them, you're leaving something off. You're leaving things off completely that you probably obviously felt really strongly about. But the movie I just couldn't shake and did have to finally make this list was Dan Gilroy's Nightcrawler, his feature debut starring Jake Gyllenhaal as a photojournalist. No, not even a photojournalist, just some kind of tabloid, sleazy kind of videographer.
Right. Freelance crime videographer
at night in L.A. And just purely in terms of memorable, disturbing, tense, and often hilarious scenes, that's what Nightcrawler is full of. And I just couldn't get rid of those. For example, it gave us one of my favorite scenes of the year, his date slash blackmailing of Rene Russo. And the climactic scene I mentioned last week, Josh, on the show when we were doing our best of the rest, and I was talking about best action scenes in non-action mm-hmm. movies, the climax of this film, and there are many others. But there's one key moment that we didn't get to during our review that makes this movie special for me and really has had it linger in my mind. Lou is not a guy too worried about ethics and has done a lot of bad things throughout the film up until this point that I'm going to mention. But there's one scene where he does really go too far, and he goes further after this, but it's pretty late in the film, so I don't want to spoil it too much. I'll just say he shoots footage of a scene that's pretty grisly, and you're shocked that he's actually shooting it. It doesn't matter what he sees or what's going on in the scene. He keeps shooting it like it doesn't have any effect on him whatsoever. He's just there to get the best footage possible. But then when he finally leaves, he gets a little bit down the road and he pulls over his car and he gets out and he goes into the trunk and he actually starts capturing and editing the footage and looking at what he's got. And while he's looking at it, Gyllenhaal is finally overwhelmed by it in the moment. There's this scene where it's kind of hard to describe what he does without seeing it, but he just takes this deep breath where it seems to be this moment where the horror of what he's looking at finally seems to register on his face. And I love that moment for three reasons. I love it because it shows us how having that camera in front of him can act kind of like a buffer. I think you can kind of turn off part of your brain that maybe feels fear, maybe even feels compassion. You can do whatever you want. You're invincible. It's all not real. A movie like Waltz with Bashir deals with this theme directly. And it's only upon seeing the footage that he does finally have that shock and that recognition. I also love it because it's Gilroy and Gyllenhaal taking a moment to show us that maybe he isn't the pure monster that we think he is at this point. But the other thing I love about it is maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe he is a monster. And it's not horror he's recoiling at all, but pure exhilaration mm-hmm. in the moment. More likely, it's a combination of the two. And I love the fact that you have that kind of juxtaposition of emotions and feelings and how it can make you feel as a viewer in that moment.
Well, it's Lou Bloom, the auteur there. He might have a spot indeed on your list, Scott. I don't know, because he's admiring his own craft, maybe.
Maybe. I really liked Nightcrawler. That's the one review I've written this year that I wish I could kind of take back a little bit. It was a positive review, but I feel like I missed an aspect of the film that, you know, readers sort of pointed out to me later. I mean, I talked a little bit in the review about, I kind of approached it as a sort of a network media commentary to a degree. And I talked a little bit in reference to the book What Makes Sammy Run is a portrait of kind of relentless, you know, American ambition. But mm-hmm. I feel like what I missed, I think, is that it's sort of a critique of the American can-do spirit.
Absolutely.
And that's the ethos he carries into mm-hmm. it. I mean, he's just going to get the job done. He's going to be aggressive. He has this vision, this philosophy that's very American. And I kind of missed that in the review, and I regret it and kind of want to revisit the film and maybe appreciate it a little bit more.
Michael, your number nine movie.
My number nine is Dear White People. This is a film I have not seen a second time. And you know, I don't know if it's the same for you guys, but in the last few weeks kind of leading up to the end of the year, you're seeing many things a second time just to see where they fall on an end-of-the-year list and to see if a film you really liked held up better, worse, about the same as, you know, what new colors do you get out of it? What regrets do you have in terms of the review you wrote 4 months ago? Right. All that sort of thing. Dear White People's not a film I've revisited yet, but I'll tell you, on the first shot, Justin Simien's really beautifully structured and I think very rich comedy, kind of a satire, sort of a comedy about, you know, black life on an Ivy League campus, and just a really kind of a racial incident that sparks this whole kind of labyrinth of plot developments. Really stimulating, and kind of one of the best American comedies I've seen this year. And it's not the kind of funny we're used to seeing on a certain level of American independent filmmaking. It's a really verbally adroit film. And you can point to all sorts of obvious precedents for Spike Lee's School Days, other Spike Lee films, all kinds of stuff. But this, I just think Simien's way with dialogue is something truly to be listened to and savored. And that I didn't get enough this year in 2014. I got a lot of very good, cleverly structured and often beautifully made films that happen to be comedies. This one, I think, really had a verbal sense of humor.
The role of counterculture is to wake up the mainstream.
I have furniture older than you. Counterculture? Is that what you think this is? Your little show?
What about my show?
The show is racist.
Black people can't be racist. Prejudice, yes, but not racist.
Racism describes a system of disadvantage based on race. Black people can't be racist since we don't stand to benefit from such a system.
Your antics are making press, Sam.
One of the Golden Brick nominees here on Film Spotting this year. Great choice. Scott, you're number nine.
My number nine is Force Majeure by Ruben Östlund. This is a, you know, I think you would call it maybe a Haneke-esque film, though I think a little less judgmental, a little funnier, but just as pristine.
There's less torture. Generally.
Less torture, and it's a little more forgiving. Yeah. A little warmth creeps in here and there, but it's about this quite literally picture perfect family. There's a picture taken of them at the beginning of the film as they're at this ski resort in the Alps, and there's this incident that happens, this controlled avalanche that takes place while they're having lunch. And it becomes not that controlled. And the father has a reaction to it that is, shall we say, less than heroic. And it's one of those things where in the aftermath, it comes up, you know, in kind of a jokingly passive-aggressive way. And then it just kind of starts to metastasize and starts in this perfect, you know, sort of bourgeois family. They're gorgeous couple, gorgeous kids, no problems in the world. You know, we just see how brittle that relationship is. But at the same time, you know, that's not where it ends. You know, that's not what I really admire. One of the many things I admire about the film is, like, that's not where it ends. It's not just an exposure of whatever the bourgeois class. It's a lot more subtle about relationships and about marriage. And it's fiendishly clever. This is a wonderful there's a couple of wonderful twists toward the end of the film that really put it on another level for me.
You might say, Scott, it's a movie that deals with masculinity in crisis.
Oh.
I'm excited. To go back to my theme.
My favorite thing about Force Majeure, and you touched on it there when you talked about the family picture at the start, the entire film is almost structured as a series of family portraits. And frequently before that avalanche, you'll get group shots of them working, either peacefully going down the hill together. The family's always together like a group, right? Yeah. In the same frame. And then after that incident, they're always separate and working on their mm-hmm. own. And it just physically breaks that up. And then you'll get some lovely moments of reuniting later on. So yeah, it's a really beautiful movie.
Whenever I think of Force Majeure, I think of, Michael, one of your recent appearances on the show. We were talking off air and you asked me if I had seen it yet. And I hadn't. You said, it's a pip. And every time I think of Force Majeure, I think of it being a pip. And 15 minutes into the movie, I'm like, Michael's right. This movie is a pip. Well, I don't know what it means, but
I would have expected a pip to be a little brighter
I don't
of a
know.
Film,
I,
though,
I
to
just,
be honest
I,
with you.
I, nothing, my favorite psych gag of the year is that apparently sustained shot of the avalanche that, hey, look, one of the aliens. All the cameras come out, and then it gets a little too close, and then there's some murmurs of worry, like, are you sure it's controlled? Oh, no, they know what they're doing, and then snow keeps coming. And it's all this sustained shot, and for about a minute, it's just kind of an astonishing mixture of funny and potentially horrifying, and then you get the results, as you say, Scott. I think that's just one of the craftiest first 20 minutes of any film I've seen in a hell of a while. We'll talk a little more about it later. We'll talk
about
it.
Spoiler alert.
Good. All right, for now, I'm at number nine, and that's where I have The Babadook. Mm. A writer-director, Jennifer Kent, she was one of my discoveries of 2014 for this small-budget horror film. I think it's a worthy entry in the parental nightmare subgenre of horror. We get a lot of movies like that. I particularly enjoy them. One of the inventive things that she does with this story is to keep us uneasy about the two main characters. There's Essie Davis's single mother and then Noah Wiseman's troubled little boy. They begin to experience these supernatural threats after reading this pop-up book called Mr. Babadook. Early on, you get the sense that maybe this is going to be a demon child movie, because this kid's he's really trouble. He's somewhat creepy. He threatens other children. He terrorizes his mother. And you wonder, OK, are we going in this direction? But then Davis herself becomes something of a villainous figure after she suffers a mental breakdown, and you swing over to the kid's side. You're like, you got to get away from your mother. You got to protect yourself.
I want to report someone stalking me and my child.
Can you tell us what happened?
Somebody sent me a children's book.
And?
And it contained violent and graphic images of my child and me being murdered.
Can we have a look at the book, please?
I burnt it.
You burnt it?
Yes.
Well, unfortunately, there's nothing we can do about it.
He's been making phone calls to me as well.
What's he been saying?
Nothing, just making these noises.
How do you know it's the same person?
Because of what he wrote in the book.
The book you burnt?
Yes.
So the result of all of this is that the people who are the victims in this story are also at turns the threats. And it's just a whole nother level of discomfort going on. It keeps us off balance right up to the end. Another brilliant thing about The Babadook is its ending, I think. It's wonderfully anticlimactic. And, you know, endings are a hard thing for horror films to stick. And this one really lands it. I made a joke on Letterboxd that I would actually like to have a copy of Mr. Babadook, the pop-up book. I want the first version, though, not the second one that the mother gets. And apparently that's now going to become possible. I saw that. There has been so much interest that they're publishing a version. $80 a pop, mind you.
Wow.
But you can order it, shipping out next year.
No thanks.
No?
I don't want any part of it. I finally caught up with the Babadook, and I enjoyed it as well. And you know, I'll just admit it, speaking of masculinity in crisis, if my wife wasn't right next to me protecting me, no way I would have gotten through the movie. Though it's not that terrifying overall. And I think actually as a real exploration of grief, the movie works very well. And that kid certainly, I think he's understandably disturbed and troubled and difficult, to put it mildly, but it certainly did make me really appreciate my brood. So maybe it is good for parents to watch every now and again when you're feeling, you know, a little disillusioned,
a little overwhelmed
with your kids.
Like, well, yeah. I don't have it so bad.
I love the fact that you could actually, if you actually just took out the most obvious 20-25 minutes of horror, of suspense and fright and horror, what you have is kind of a sickly black comedy about a sleep-deprived single parent who's just basically having trouble coping, you know?
And it
seems
shot,
completely legitimate.
Scariest you know? Shot in the film is the one where the mother's laying in the bed, just utterly exhausted, and the kid, she's in close-up, and the kid's in the background just constantly asking for more food. And you just see on her face, you see on her face like the rage starting to build, right? Yeah.
My number 9 film is a movie I was hooked from the opening scene. And it's an opening scene that you talked in detail about with the director of this movie. The director is John Michael McDonough, also the writer of that film. Michael, we discussed this movie on the show. It's Calvary. And the star is Brendan Gleeson. That opening scene I mentioned, he's a small village parish priest in Ireland. And he is told in this opening confession scene that he is going to be murdered by the guy confessing in 7 days. And the camera just stays on Gleeson, really one of our best actors going these days, just stays on him for the whole 4 minutes as he takes this in. And it opens with a really bracing line about a personal trauma that the confessor confesses. And when there's silence from Brendan Gleeson, he says, "Nothing to say." And Gleeson responds with, "Certainly is a startling opening line." And it really is horrific what the person says, and yet he does make a little bit of a joke out of it. And I think that really is the crux of the movie, this sense of levity and this dark humor in the face of real kind of hopelessness and despair and some really grim subject matter. Andrew O'Hare, writing at Salon, described it well. I thought he said, "McDonough walks a hazardous tightrope from scene to scene, from amiable comedy to black-hearted farce to heartbreaking tragedy, often trying to strike all those notes within seconds. It doesn't all work equally well, but the cumulative effect is powerful." And it definitely was powerful for me. I think the quip about opening lines, too, from Gleeson, it speaks to, like McDonough's brother Martin McDonough, the meta element to his work. As well, characters throughout this movie are constantly calling attention to themselves as players within a story. And I think that makes sense because they are kind of part of this larger narrative of Ireland and the church and the fallout from their scandals. I think that the other thing, Michael, we talked about when we discussed this show, the real interesting thing, more than anything, maybe not the mystery so much of who it is and who's going to carry this act out on the priest. The thing that really sustained me was the complexity of the feelings his flock has for him. Hmm. The way they feel, they seem to feel a sense of reverence for him, and they do have some respect for him while also hating his guts. They really just feel, I think, the same way for him, the way they feel about the church and largely feel about themselves. It's also a movie that kind of goes back to my number 10 pick, Nightcrawler. The 2 times this year in a review, I talked about scenes really feeling like transactions. Every scene, there's something exchanged between characters where characters are kind of saying to each other, "Okay, I just gave you this or just admitted this. What do I get for that honesty? What am I going to get for what I just confessed, and what price do I have to pay?" And so that combination of, again, the humor and the drama, a little bit of an experiment almost, I think, on McDonough's part, and he pulled it off really successfully for me.
I had a word there with Veronica, Jack.
You're out of the house, were you? Is everything all right?
Everything's fine. I mean, no, everything's not fine. Mass on Sunday? With the shades and everything?
Oh, that.
Yes, that. Are you laying into her, or what's going on? That wasn't me, though. No, that's that black fella that she's been seeing. I mean, the current fella she's been seeing. Sorry, I didn't mean to be racist there. That was a slip of the tongue.
You're saying he beats her up?
Don't quote me on it, but that's what I'm assuming. Yeah. I mean, she speaks in riddles half of the time. I can't make any sense out of her. I think she's bipolar or lactose intolerant, one of the two.
That's Calvary, my number 9 film of the year. And I think with that, Josh, we're going to take a quick break from the countdown.
Yeah, we'll give you guys a little bit of a respite here. It's Film Spotting poll time when we come back, including our announcement of this year's Golden Brick winner, as chosen by you, the listener. You're sure you're okay with giving up this much control, Adam?
How do you know I didn't just rig the results, Josh?
There's a chance of that.
In keeping with our end-of-year tradition, we asked friend of the show, Sam Smith, to curate some of his favorite 2014 movie scores. We'll feature some of his choices in both parts 1 and 2 of the show. Up first, Grand Budapest Hotel. But before that, a voicemail from Sam, a designer who has done the art for several Criterion Collection DVD editions. Here are his picks for the best movie posters of the year. Stay with us.
Hey guys, it's Sam Smith, listener, designer, and host of the new podcast, The Poster Boys. I wanted to let you know my favorite movie poster designs of the year. It's pretty much a tie between Neil Kellerhaus's poster for Under the Skin and the poster designed by Annie Atkins for the Grand Budapest Hotel. She designed the title treatment you see there, the poster itself, and literally all the props in the movie. So pretty impressive work from her. And some other favorites, The One I Love by Kiko Sternberger, Brandon Schaefer's poster for Borgman, and Kellerhaus again for Gone Girl. Thanks, guys, and Happy New Year.
Adam and Josh, this is Ryan Johnson calling in. I want to really quickly get in my number one movie for the year, which is Under the Skin, which I think is just an absolute masterpiece and is one of my favorite movies of the past decade, let alone this year. But I'm really also calling in to announce the winner of the Golden Brick.
Hold your horses there, Ryan. Not just yet. Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. Also joining us this week for our Best of 2014 Countdown, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and The Dissolve, Scott Tobias. We'll get back to our picks of the year's best in a bit. But first, we do want to talk a little bit about Ryan Johnson. It's been a big year for Ryan. I think the biggest thing, of course, was his appearance on our 500th episode.
By far.
Just distancing.
Physically the biggest.
Yes, it
huge,
was.
Huge, 40,
big
50 foot head.
At the Music Box. I guess he did also have that big moment when it was announced that he'd be writing and directing the second of the J.J. Abrams-produced Star Wars sequels. That would be Episode 8 due, I don't know, 2017-ish?
Sounds right. And I think it was his Film Spotting appearance that landed him that gig.
I'm sure.
That sealed the deal.
Okay. Might have been a week after it, but I like that theory.
It proved he could handle exposition gracefully.
There you go.
Not that we really need anything else to get us excited about Ryan's take on Star Wars, but just for a second, objectively speaking, how great is it that the director of one of the next Star Wars movies names as his favorite film, not just of this year, but he actually says, of the last decade, Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin.
Apparently, I severely underrated it at slot number 10 there.
You did indeed.
Oh my gosh.
Severely underrated. So we'll get back to Ryan and we'll get to the Golden Bricks in a moment. Right now, just a little bit of Yay Us time, if you'll indulge us for a second. Just this past Sunday, Slate announced its top 25 podcast episodes of all time. And I know a lot of our listeners saw this on Facebook and have seen some notes about it on Twitter. The feedback has really been wonderful. Thank you for all the emails. And it's not just the top 25 podcasts. They are picking actually podcast episodes, which I don't really know what's more remarkable, the fact that the folks at Slate undertook that effort to cull through all of those and really pick which episodes made the cut, or the fact that Film Spotting made the cut. They actually named our two-part Film Spotting number 300 episode among their top 25. We clocked in at number 15. That was recorded back in May 2010 with then-host Maddie Robinson. Sam Van Halgren, our producer now and original Film Spotting co-host, was also on that episode. And Scott Tobias, Michael Phillips, special guest. I think that's what pushed us over the hump.
Putting it over the top.
Your voicemails there. That was celebrating 5 years. Of course, now we're celebrating 10 years and 500 episodes of the show. So looking back on it real quick, I think we did want to acknowledge that what makes that episode special, because it definitely isn't hearing me talk about Mulholland Drive for the 27th time, is just how big a part of the show Film Spotting listeners are. There's a ton of voicemails and feedback, and really just a reminder of what it is after almost 10 years that's made this show so much fun to do, and it is every one of you out there listening. So thank you for that, and we do want to say thanks to Slate for the honor. Josh, I am trying to get Sam to digitally insert you somehow into the show just so the whole gang will be there.
Yeah. But that would make me like Jabba the Hutt when George Lucas messed with the original Star Wars and he's sliming out to the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah,
I don't want that.
You'd love
that. I don't like the remastered, whatever you call them. So.
Okay.
Well, thanks. Congratulations.
Thank you, Scott.
That's great news.
It took 299 episodes of trial and error, but you finally yes. got there with episode 300.
Indeed. Well, I also want to say thank you to you guys, not only for appearing on that episode, but for dressing up for this recording, because I don't know if our invitation made note of the fact that this taping is doubling as our fifth annual Golden Brick Awards ceremony and gala. You guys look splendid.
I'm always dressed.
Michael in tails. Sure. Which
is
great.
The Golden Globes, though, we don't serve champagne. It's just hard cider. Is that okay? Do you guys like that yeah. stuff?
Good. Well, one of our wonderful producers, Golden Joe Dassault, I can see him through the glass. And I believe we still have that Golden Brick theme song from last year's live show. Maybe we can cue that up.
It's the Golden Brick Award. Put on your helmet and your sword. Bow down to the Lord.
The genius there of Abraham Levitan. Maybe my biggest regret about us not doing a rap party this year is not having Abraham's involvement.
Sure. But it makes me think we did our Best of the Rest show, which was kind of a bastardized version of the rap party. We stole some categories. Why didn't we have Abraham just sit in the corner of the studio with
You're
the two of
late.
Us?
You're a little late, Josh.
I know. Regrets.
But appropriate that that's our Golden Brick theme song, which was improvise on the spot, which is more or less what we've been doing with the Golden Brick criteria for the last 5 years on the show. And that brings us back to Ryan Johnson. I reached out to Ryan and asked him if he could somehow find the time, you know, just slink away from making a Star Wars movie to announce the winner of this year's Golden Brick Award, because hopefully listeners are aware that the Brick is named for his 2006 debut movie, Brick, a film that really knocked us out at the time and one we were able to turn a lot of listeners onto. And I think that really does sum up perfectly the Golden Brick criteria. Debut film, smart, surprising, inventive movie, and a lot of listeners probably wouldn't have seen it if we didn't bring it to their attention. So before we let Ryan finally announce this year's winner, Josh, let's hear the nominees one last time.
We had six of them. We had Blue Ruin from director Jeremy Saulnier. Calvary, already mentioned on Adam's list. That's written and directed by John Michael McDonough. Dear White People, a couple of these are getting some attention already. Michael's pick there. Written and directed by Justin Simeon. Mistaken for Strangers is another option. That was the documentary about the rock band The National, directed by first-time filmmaker Tom Berninger, who's the brother of The National's lead singer Matt Berninger. The One I Love was another option, the debut from director Charlie McDowell. And finally here, Startup, the British prison drama from director David McKenzie.
So we'll hear Michael and Scott and get your pick if you had a vote in the Golden Brick Award, but you didn't, because we left it up to the listeners, and we are going to finally make way for Ryan Johnson and the announcement of this year's Golden Brick winner.
The winner this year is a movie that I really loved so much. The winner is Blue Ruin by Jeremy Saulnier. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Jeremy. And it's a stunning, amazing little gothic noir that is tight and it's beautiful, and the visual storytelling in it is just tight as a drum. It really reminded me of Blood Simple. And it has a fantastic performance by Macon Blair in the lead.
Call them?
Who's them, cops?
Your family.
What do you want me to say?
We're all gonna meet up somewhere public. And this is gonna end.
Okay.
Don't say my name. And don't mention the gun. And we're in Kentucky.
Just a terrific movie. I'm so happy that it got voted the winner of the Golden Brick. Hope you guys had a terrific year. Thanks for all the great shows, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Ryan. That really couldn't have worked out better. Not only did he share that voicemail and announce the winner for us, but it turns out he loved the movie. So congratulations to Jeremy, who we now have competing versions of how to pronounce his name. I believe, I looked this up, it's Jeremy Sunier.
Oh, wow.
So we've all been wrong.
I was
going to
say,
time.
That's the third version.
Yeah, third version.
Great.
We're going to go with that one.
What happened to the L?
Is it Sunier Previn?
It is not.
It's not Sunier Previn?
No. Okay. No, just Jeremy Sunier, which is really fun to say. Actually, I recommend you all do it. And let's get to the poll results, because we did, Josh, leave it up to the listeners this year, and we think they made a very good choice. With 35% of the vote, Blue Ruin was the winner. Calvary was in second with 26%. Startup third, 15%. The One I Love with 10%. Mistaken for Strangers, just 7%. And alas, Michael, Dear White People, in last place with only 6%, probably due largely to the fact that it's the hardest one to see. It's only been playing in theaters for a few weeks, and the rest have all been out for a while and available on DVD or on demand in various platforms. So probably a reason there against Dear White People, but we appreciate all the votes we got, and we appreciate all the feedback we got as well. Let's hear some of that feedback from listeners who weighed in on the poll.
That includes Josh Oakley. He said, Mistaken for Strangers is not just the winner of this poll for me. It's my third favorite of the year, after Boyhood and Love is Strange. My favorite aspect of the film is that the very fact it was created is inspiring in and of itself. The entire doc is a journey for director Tom Berninger, learning to believe that he, and anyone really, deserves to be the lead in their own story. That we see him editing the film really brings him home. Though formally different, this reminds me a lot of last year's Stories We Tell, where the film is about storytelling and the way we shape our stories and the stories around us. A powerful look at brotherhood, self-confidence, and, in a post-credit scene that blows anything Marvel has done out of the water, the innate power of rock and roll.
Well said.
Luke Schultes wrote in and said, my finger hovered over Calvary for a split second, but since I found a lot of positive reviews on it, aside from that of Film Spotting, chances were that I would have seen it anyway. My vote goes to Mistaken for Strangers. There was so much about this movie that I loved, but it deserves the Golden Brick because I think it's the most film spottingest movie on the list. Movies about movie making, meta elements, two men who really care about each other deep down but argue over silly things.
Nice.
And because it comes with the extra nugget that it may also turn you on to The National.
Okay, so a lot of love for that documentary.
They are not silly things, though, Luke. They're very important things.
Absolutely.
All right, this comes from Dom from Australia. Calvary wins it for me. I loved The Guard. Funny, sad, thrilling, intriguing, and expecting something similar from McDonough with another Brendan Gleeson starring Irish flick featuring comedic actors Chris O'Dowd and Dylan Moran. But any comedy here is as black as it gets, and instead we get a film that takes a hard look at some big themes: the circle of violence, forgiveness, the flaws of the Catholic Church, while remaining entertaining throughout. Plus an ending that you just wouldn't get from Hollywood. You just know whatever comes next from McDonough and Gleason will be worth seeing.
I second that. Sean Cook says, my vote perhaps shouldn't count as much as some others, as I haven't seen all of the movies on this list, but for me, The One I Love is the winner. It was such a playful but cerebral film about love that despite its few shortcomings, I still can't stop thinking about, and that's truly what I want from a film. I want a journey that puts me into someone's life and mine, while also making me ask important questions about myself and the relationships in my life. Not since Eternal Sunshine has a film combined magical realism and deep questions about love in such a complex and interesting way.
One more quick one here from Joshua Heiser. I don't see how it could be anything but Startup. All great nominees, but the performances in this film outshine anything else from the year. Fantastic film.
Yeah, and Jack O'Connell, we were big on his performance. Happy to see that the Chicago Film Critics Association, which we're a part of, wisely voted him as the best newcomer, most promising performer of the year for that performance. So thank you to everyone who voted again and who shared some of your feedback. That brings us to this week's poll question. Simply, we're sharing our top 10 films of 2014. We want to know what you think the best film of 2014 is. And we could feature several high-profile films that won't go into wide release until closer to the new year or later, in the case of P.T. Anderson's Inherent Vice not opening here in Chicago until January 9th, but those are not represented on the poll. We will be giving you another option. We encourage you to share your favorite film along with a pithy defense. Has to be a pithy defense of your pick in the poll comments. So you can vote now at filmspotting.net. And as always, if you leave us a comment, please let us know where you're listening from. I don't want to deprive our listeners, though, guys, I said that you guys were going to have to weigh in on the Golden Brick vote. If you had it, which way would you have gone, Scott?
I would have gone the way the listeners. I'm going to pander. You guys are great.
Blue Ruin.
You guys know exactly what you're doing. Blue Ruin, which I absolutely loved. It's so much fun. It does evoke the Coen brothers. And I mean, it's about a guy who is committing revenge, but he's an ordinary guy. He doesn't know how to do it. This does not come easily to him, and it leads to a lot of very tense and very funny situations. And I thought it was a terrific little thriller.
Okay, Scott, going with the herd. Michael,
I would have to assert my previously stated affection for Dear White People. You know? No, I really do. I think it's a film that not much distribution. It's getting out here and there on various platforms, but I think the more people discover it, the more people will actually find that it's worth discovering.
Dear White People on your list, Michael. We'll see if any of the other Golden Brick nominees make it to our list of our favorite films of 2014. We're going to jump back into those top 10 lists in just a moment.
And in the break, another one of Sam Smith's favorite 2014 scores from Michel Gondry's Mood Indigo. Stay with us.
Matt Singer from Film Spotting SVU, calling with my best film of 2014, and this year I'm going with the obvious choice, but I think it's obvious for a reason, and that is Richard Linklater's Boyhood, and I'm sort of taking the short-term view and the long-term view here. Short-term, it was a film I saw several times, and I loved more the second time I saw it. The film just adored and thought was brilliant, and then in the long-term, I just think this is a movie that it's going to stick around. People are going to be talking about this movie in 12 years when the next Boyhood iteration perhaps comes out, or the next thing like Boyhood comes out, or in 100 years. It just seems like something that is such an achievement. It's so creative and brilliant and beautiful and interesting that it's one I want to get behind early. And if people haven't seen it, they really, really should. Thanks very much. Have a great holiday season. And, take care. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Getting us back to our top 10 films of 2014 countdown is Film Spotting SVU host and, of course, from Screen Crush, formerly of The Dissolve, Matt Singer. I don't know, Scott, if you harbor any ill will towards Matt Singer for abandoning you. I'm just hitting you with it.
Really? That's stuff for another like hour-long extra podcast.
Drama.
No ill will, not at all. Matt really did a lot to establish the voice of The Dissolve. He was an incredibly hard worker, and we love him and miss him dearly.
Okay. Yeah.
Personally, he strikes me as kind of a weasel. No?
I say with my teeth gritted, but...
Michael Phillips, for the record, has said many a nice thing about Matt Singer on this show and off of this show. So,
he's left his weasel days behind.
He has. And certainly a very astute pick there for his number one film of the year, Richard Linklater's Boyhood. We're going to quickly recap our 10 through 9 picks before getting back to the countdown. Michael, yours were?
Number 10, Heaven Knows What, and number 9, Dear White People.
Number 10, The Missing Picture, and number 9, Force Majeure.
My number 10 was Under the Skin. My number 9 was The Babadook.
I had at number 10, Nightcrawler, and Calvary at number 9. So that does bring us to number 8, Michael.
Number 8, Mike Leigh's Mr. Turner. I think the theme for me, one of the themes this year, now that we're actually talking about theme, and I'm with Scott on this, it's a ridiculous task to look at 250 movies and get the handy one-sentence theme out of it. But I did see an awful lot of movies the last few months about ego and the artistic drive and kind of the perils of both, and just really kind of what it takes to devote your life to an artistic pursuit. And it's so easy to be kind of, you know, falsely noble about it. It's so easy to be kind of reductively melodramatic about it. Everything. Mike Leigh wants none of that. I love Mr. Turner because it taught me a little bit about, not in a documentary way, but it taught me a little bit about J.M.W. Turner's life and his art and a little bit about his personal life. But Leigh doesn't care at all about larding any biopic with the usual biopic nonsense. I mean, why? It's the same reason I loved Mike Leigh's Topsy Turvy, the Gilbert and Sullivan film. This just has a slightly bigger budget, just enough to really immerse you in the settings and the life of this man, beautifully played by Timothy Spall. I've seen it twice. It held up beautifully a second time, and I really look forward to writing about it. So, yeah, that's Mr. Turner, top 10.
Yeah, I mean, immerse is definitely the right word for that movie. That's the difference with him with both Topsy-Turvy and this. It's not only his resistance to the usual historical biopic cliches, but just the fact that his whole process is so relentlessly detail-oriented that it really sort of transports you back to this time.
And you know what I love about it, too? There's not one line of dialogue in that film where you have to suffer through Turner, as played by Spall, announcing or pronouncing what sort of art or artist he believes
Never.
In or is compelled by. None of that. It's much more it's much more kind of quotidian, everyday, realistic sort of things about, like, oh my God, the price of paint is going up. And, you know, just like very kind of workaday stuff. And yet a lot of it's really witty and all of it seems truthful to me. So, yeah, no, I love it.
Scott, you're number 8.
My number 8 is Listen Up, Philip by writer-director Alex Ross Perry. This film is just so nasty and caustic, and it identifies in a very unsparing and very specific way this sort of East Coast man of letters, you know, and you've seen this character.
Artistic ego, man. I'm telling you, it's the theme of the
year. It's all coming together, right? I mean, you know, this is the type of person you've seen in Woody Allen movies. You've seen him in, you know, Noah Baumbach is probably a good point of comparison. But this film is just so much harsher than those movies. But at the same time, it's pretty well-rounded, too. You know, it's got all these jagged edges, but then, you know, there's these characters played by Jonathan Pryce, who's sort of this Philip Roth type. And the film kind of comes back to her and spends some time with her and deals with, you know, the wreckage that he sort of left in her life. And it's just, the film is just, it's messy in a very artful, deliberate way. It's like, it's not smooth around the edges, and I really appreciate that.
Okay, could you stop doing that? It's really annoying.
I planned on going away for a week.
You know this is important to me.
I know, but it wasn't supposed to start for 10 days.
They changed it. I don't know what to tell you. You're not being really supportive right now. You know this is an amazing opportunity for me.
Tell me the good version of this conversation.
You got the job? Congratulations, Ashley. I'm so happy for you. Although I admit to being a little disappointed, I understand that these things happen. I'm so proud of you, baby.
That's basically what I said. I would never say that.
Listen Up, Philip has my favorite female performance of the year, Elizabeth Moss's.
Yeah, she's and just my fantastic. Favorite single moment of acting in a year.
Exactly.
Yep.
I think we're thinking of the same scene for sure. My number 8 was my biggest surprise of the movie year, and it's Maleficent. I was not prepared for how taken aback I was going to be at.
I was not prepared for that pick, actually.
None of us were.
We were also taken aback.
I went into this thing, you know, with the family thinking, sure, we'll check it out. Jolie looks interesting in the trailer. And this is really potent. It's a retelling of the Sleeping Beauty story, this time from the point of view of the evil fairy Maleficent, played by Jolie, of course. Jolie, she's the reason this thing sings. I mean, she gives the line readings and the costuming the seriousness that they deserve without falling into camp. And you need a star to be able to do that, someone who has star power. And she pulls that off. Now, first-time director here, Robert Stromberg, and he's been blamed for relying on too much CGI imagery. There is a lot of it here, I'll admit that. But he also manages some fantastic fairy tale images. One of my favorite shots of the year involves Maleficent's wings and employs mostly practical effects. I don't want to get into it because it's will give some plot things away. The screenplay is by Linda Wolverton, and I think it's actually quite subversive in what it does with the accepted notions of gender and power in our princess stories. So this isn't just a revisionist tale that's one of these silly fractured fairy tales. There's something more intentional going on here than a good time. And in fact, you know, in how it details what happens to Maleficent that turns her towards this other path and how it traces the ensuing psychological drama, I think the movie is a fairly blatant allegory for surviving sexual assault. And that's something that, you know, this came out in the first quarter, I believe, of the year, maybe the first half. It's only gained more resonance for me because what's one of the big stories that's developed this year? Campus rape. That's what a lot of the discussion has been in 2014. And this movie speaks to that, I think. All that being said, I don't want to scare people away because it still works on the level of a family movie. It really does. My daughter was Maleficent for Halloween, so it has that working for it as well, that kids will be able to tap into it. And I think, you know, like all good popular art, it has that, but there's something else going on underneath, at least there was for
me. Wouldn't you say it's got a heavy-duty crossover with the audience appeal with Wicked, the stage show Wicked, you know, which is a...
I think they're trying to do different things in refashioning these familiar figures. Yeah, maybe. Maybe it does in that sense.
Well, Josh, I'm not mad at you for the pick. I am mad at you that you ruined our string of Michael's theme of ego and artistic drive, because it could have been four in a row.
Okay.
But you blew it. I'm going to try to cap it off, though, Michael, with my number eight pick, and it is Whiplash, the movie starring Miles Teller as an aspiring jazz drummer at a very prestigious conservatory being pushed by J.K. Simmons. And it's interesting that you have Mr. Turner that started this conversation off, because it's a really good point of comparison, I think, in the sense that this is a movie, Whiplash, where you have a character constantly talking about what he wants to be and viewing himself as his future great artist as a jazz drummer. And of course, he's much younger than Turner is. When we come to Mr. Turner, we see him later in his life and maybe the last 25 or 30 years, but he's a fully realized artist and he doesn't spend time thinking about what kind of artist he's going to be. He simply is. He simply lives it. And the Miles Teller character here isn't quite ready to live it yet.
Also, Turner was a fabulous jazz drummer.
I'm sure he was. Yeah, I'm sure he was. But yeah, Andrew Neiman.
A pioneer, really. I mean, because he was doing it 100 years.
100 years before it even existed. So how about that? Yeah. Andrew, though, just really isn't comfortable enough yet in his skin, at least as an artist. And he really is sort of being abused and being pushed, maybe in a good direction, depending how you kind of read the end of the film, by his instructor, Fletcher.
Start counting.
5, 6, 7.
In four, damn it! Look at me!
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Now, was I rushing or was I dragging?
No.
Count again.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Rushing or dragging?
Rushing.
So you do know the difference.
In terms of just sheer intensity and unnerving pleasure, though, this movie is up there with anything I saw this year, particularly as we get to the climax of the film. And there's another theme for me this year with some of my other picks, my previous two films and also some future choices, this idea of playing a role. And it's not so much with the Andrew character, but with Fletcher, and one scene in particular that I really like in this movie. And it's the one where he's been just this incredibly hard-driving instructor, just ruthless and vicious. And then he gets some bad news about a former pupil and he can't teach the class. And he sits down and he actually becomes emotional. He kind of sheds a tear, or as close as Fletcher is going to come. He seems to act like a human with real emotions. And he relates the story of this pupil and how he did some transcendent work as a jazz musician and how sad it is that he's not going to be able to do that anymore. And the scene works as an emotional scene. You believe Fletcher in the moment, I think, that he genuinely feels that way about this loss, while also, I think, believing that he may have done it entirely to manipulate his players, right? To get them on his side. After all the beatdowns he's given them, he gives them this moment of genuine emotion to make them think that he really cares about them and will continue to care about them after they've left this school. And you know what? Even if it is a little bit of acting there on his part, if it's a little bit fake, I don't know that it actually makes it phony or less true. I think if it gets the desired result, then maybe it's all worth it. And Josh, one of the things that when we reviewed this movie, I mentioned in bonus content, maybe we'd get to kind of how I saw this movie in jazz relating to this concept of art and seeking perfection and how I thought it just fit perfectly with that. And we never made time for it. Perfection, I think, in art is one of those things that's just not attainable. And I do hate it when film critics and others throw around phrases like it's not perfect, because of course it was never going to be perfect, and I don't think we need to hold it up to that. But jazz is an art where, you know, there's a precision to it that's different than with other popular musics, I think, or other popular forms of art in general. Like, you wouldn't sit there with a painter or a sculptor and analyze every single technique they have. But with a drummer in particular, or with a jazz musician, there are certain things that you simply can do or you can't do. Just there's that bar of entry to get into the game. Mm. And if you can't do those things, if you can't do some of those definable techniques, play double time, swing at a certain rate, you're never going to eventually get to that level of a jazz musician that you want to get to. So you can play a song 100 times, 1,000 times, and maybe feel like there's a perfect version of it still out there if somehow you just demand enough of yourself. And I think that's what this movie ultimately really gets at. I also love the performances, of course, J.K. Simmons as Fletcher and Miles Teller.
And one of the great twists of the film along those lines is that when they achieve their moment of perfection in that climax, it's a holy mess, right? Or at least it comes out of a holy mess. So, yeah, it does have a lot of fun with that idea of perfection and what it looks like.
That brings us to our number 7 films of 2014. Michael Phillips, I turn to you.
Force Majeure is my number 7. Force Majeure, we've already talked about it here, but it's black comedy, I think, it's all a matter of tone and getting everybody to play in the same universe and not tip your hand about what, you know, where things are going in any way. The one thing I'd kind of argue with you on, Scott, is what I get from the image of this family that is on vacation in the Alps is not so much a picture perfect bourgeois model of upper middle class kind of perfection so much, but it's just right away things seem a little, you know, they're all kind of in their own electronic orbits all the time. You know, the father we hear is a workaholic who's basically, you know, the wife keeps saying, well, you know, he needs to spend more time with the family. We're all here to spend time together. And, you know, he's doing it sort of semi-reluctantly. You sort of get the feeling. And it's all just – there's little hints, I think, at the behavior you see that comes out of the key avalanche sequence. And the funny thing about Force Majeure is when you just hear that there's something to do with a family and an avalanche and what happens next, everyone – for months, everybody kind of assumed, oh, Force Majeure, it's an Irwin Allen film. It's a disaster movie. You know? And it, in fact, no, it's much closer to, as you say, Michael Haneke or I don't know. I love it. And the guy gave a great, the director gave a wonderful interview in the Times where he just said, look, if my film can cause at least one divorce, I'll be a happy man.
I love it.
Because it's all about you know, like how you perform in a crisis, how you as one half of a marital couple perform under extreme duress and at your lowest moment does, in fact, sort of point to your future, whatever that's going to be. And that's why I love this movie.
When you're talking about the family being in their own electronic orbits, too, there's a delicacy, because that's a trope, right? The dad's on his phone too much. But there's a delicacy to how Force Majeure handles that.
Why'd you look at me when you said that?
off your phone, Adam, I'm talking. The early scene where they're all laying on the bed. Another one of these family compositions, right? They're all on the same bed, napping. And his phone's buzzing, and he says, I'm not going to get that. Second later, the wife gets up, goes into the bathroom, and so he grabs it right away.
Yeah.
Right? But how they undercut that is she comes out, sees him, and laughs. And they laugh about it together. And I think it's just a tiny example of how this movie, you never know exactly where you stand with the family, where they stand with each other, because it's not laid out there, bad dad.
Right. Yes, and it's not just a cheap joke.
Right.
The movie itself, I suppose, is a cheap joke, but it's the highest, most sophisticated sort of cheap joke about masculine behavior. Let's say it, Adam. It's the damn theme for the year.
It is.
Let's assert it.
At least for my top 10. I don't know about the year. What about your number 7, Scott? Any cheap jokes in there?
Is it about masculinity in some way? Kind of. It's The Immigrant by James Gray. This is
Adam's favorite film.
It's a film that got
not in my top 10.
This is a film that got horribly abused by the company that is distributing it. It opened to terrific reviews, including from The Dissolve, and it won some awards recently. And yet, it doesn't even appear on their awards page. You know, I feel terrible for the fate of this movie because I feel like it's the one movie this year that sort of embodies the phrase, they don't make them like they used to. I mean, this is such a throwback movie. This is set in Ellis Island, 1921. It's got a very stately quality to it. It's about a Polish woman who comes over with her sister. Her sister is quarantined with a lung illness, and she's bound for the next ship out. She's played by Marion Cotillard. Joaquin Phoenix plays the guy who's preys on women just like this. Sort of, you know, he's a manager at a burlesque, and sort of brings her along. But one of the things that's so remarkable about this movie and about this dynamic between these two characters is that she is in this incredibly compromised position. She has absolutely no power, but she just insists on her dignity and maintaining her dignity and not crossing these lines that he is pushing her to cross. And it really challenges him and leads him into these sort of fits of self-loathing. And you know, I think those two performances are remarkable. I think Darius Kanji's photography. I think James Gray's choice of locations on a limited budget. The whole project just has a richness to it. It's almost a novelistic quality. Yeah, I really love it.
Who's that?
My sister, my mother, and my father.
Beautiful.
Her name is Magda.
Where are your parents now?
They're dead.
Do you mind asking what happened?
They were killed by soldiers. They cut their head off and they make a switch. Don't touch me. Don't touch me.
Shame on you. Shame! I don't need to force myself on you. You are a stranger to me. And you come into my home, I feed you, I take care of you, and you steal from us!
Well, I don't have The Immigrant on my list. That's another one Ab and I both severely dismissed earlier in the year, but I do have a reference to it later in my list. It might not be until part two, though, so I'll get to that. Okay. My number seven film is Only Lovers Left Alive, and I think this has been somewhat forgotten in the year-end rush. I haven't seen it on a lot of top 10 lists, but months after I did see the film, it still stands. I think it stands as one of Jim Jarmusch's best films, which is high praise for me. Now, I didn't see The Fault in Our Stars earlier this year, but I can't imagine a more romantic movie couple from 2014 than Adam and Eve. This is the vampire lovers who have spent centuries watching humanity from the shadows. Probably helps that they're played by Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton in the film to perfection. They ooze longing.
Josh, I have to say, I would love to see Jim Jarmusch's version of The Fault in Our Stars.
Maybe this is it. Maybe this is it, because there's something similar here. Like those doomed teen lovers, imminent death hangs over Adam and Eve, but the catch is it's not their death, it's ours, right? It's humanity's. That's what they're watching. And I think the movie is ultimately about this idea that we as humans often fail to appreciate the time that we have. And because this is an art film, we also fail to appreciate the great art that we have before us during our time.
I don't understand why you don't live in the same place, because you can't live without each other. Anyway, give my regards to that suicidally romantic scoundrel.
Do you really think he is?
Scoundrel?
Well, let's hope he's just romantic. Even so, I mainly blame Shelley and Byron and some of those French assholes he used to hang around with.
God, I wish that I'd met him before I wrote Hamlet. He would have provided the most perfect role model imaginable.
So at the end of the year, it does seem fitting. We're celebrating great films that Only Lovers Left Alive has this feel of the challenge. That's what it was for me when I saw it the first time, and it still kind of stands that way. It's Jarmusch's call to both make great art and appreciate it when we can.
It's a really good film. It's a lovely movie. I'm really glad it made your list, Josh.
All right.
Because unfortunately, I'm one of those people who sort of forgot it here, end of year. Didn't forget it.
Did you consider it, though?
Oh, I did.
Okay.
Actually. So just didn't quite make the cut for the top 10. What did make the cut, though, my number seven film, is a movie I just finally caught up with, and it was so good it did crack the list here, make it all the way to number seven. It's Ira Sachs' movie Love is Strange.
Yeah, good film.
And this is a movie, just briefly, featuring John Lithgow and Alfred Molina. They play a couple in New York City. They've been together for 39 years. They finally tie the knot, taking advantage of the marriage laws. And unfortunately, that does lead to some repercussions from Alfred Molina's job. He's let go, and they go through this tough time where they are short on money and have to sell their place and kind of split up. And stay with various family members until they can get back on their feet.
Now, we invited you all here today because, well, your family.
Are you telling us you're getting divorced already?
That's what I thought, too.
No. We have to sell the apartment. And we found a buyer already. So pretty soon, we're going to have to move out. Now, it won't be long before I get another job, and shouldn't be long before we find another apartment, but in the meantime...
It's just a transition phase, probably just a week or two.
We need a place to stay.
Michael, you're our resident film historian here, so I don't know, maybe
More than Scott or, you know.
You can touch on maybe the connections to Leo McCarey and
Make Great
for
film,
Tomorrow
yeah, great
and,
film.
And Tokyo Story. Obviously, yeah. I'm familiar with Tokyo Story. I don't know how much of this film really is inspired by Make Way for Tomorrow, but Ira Sachs, I remember liking Keep the Lights On, his most recent film, but I was floored by Love is Strange, and maybe you guys can weigh in here and tell me whether or not Ira Sachs made a significant jump as a filmmaker or I missed something in Keep the Lights On, because it feels that way to me anyway, that this is a significantly more accomplished film than Keep the Lights On. And one of the reasons I feel that way is thinking about the subject matter and how melodramatic and frankly loud the material could have been, but how just dramatic and incisive and how insightful it is about relationships, family dynamics, about getting older and the direction. The cinematography is gorgeous. You've got some of these real painterly compositions, but they're not overly fussy. Combining music and the editing, there's some sequences that just stand on their own as stunning, separate from how they function within the rest of the film. But also I love how he uses time and imagery to tell the story, convey mood and emotion. There's really so much unspoken in this movie that you're not at all lost or confused about because of the economy of storytelling. And it really sets it up right from the very beginning of the movie. And I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a key sequence late in the movie, a key transition point with a major character that I knew in the moment exactly what was occurring or about to occur with this character just because of how that moment and everything leading up to that moment, plus a little bit of foreshadowing earlier in the film, is presented by Ira Sachs. You know everything you need to know without a word being uttered. And when I think about just great direction of a movie, how, again, all the things I mentioned, but also just using the camera and the distance between characters to say something in that space, using all the visual and oral tools available to him, and how meticulously he tells the story, but also keeping it poetic. Sachs pulled it off. It's just a movie that blew me away, as I said. And at the end of the film, there's a shot in this movie. There's a sequence where, guys, it didn't just get a little bit dusty for me. I really was full on stifling tears at the end of this movie.
Same. I think
I don't get moved that often by a movie in the way I did with Love.
Yeah, the last 10 minutes of that film has, and it's not an oblique movie. It's very clear and straightforward about the situation that this gay couple finds itself in and how it's, and how the immediate family members they're sort of parceled out to or spending time with are, you know, variously ambivalent or sort of concerned or, you know, annoyed by, you know, it's just how it's about how people are kind of like dealing with close quarter situations under stress. But the last 10 minutes is kind of got this open air quality. It's just got really, I mean, it really reminded me of the best of Boyhood all of a sudden. I mean, I never thought about Boyhood in relation to Love is Strange or vice versa, but it really does feel like it's a new chapter opening up, and in a character that you didn't think necessarily the movie would end with.
Yeah.
But it feels right, and it feels like the filmmaker didn't program it or diagram it. He sort of felt his way to that ending. It's a beaut, and it's just a wonderful showcase for, especially guys like Lithgow and Alfred Molina, spend so much of their career making lots of money overacting by about 30%. And because the scripts call for it, the directors say, fine, love it, just give me more of that ham, you know. And
not happening here.
And not happening here because they're smart enough actors still, despite all the success, to just sort of calm down, figure out what a long-term married couple or, you know, a couple that is now newly married, you know, how they can kind of get under each other's skin in both good and not so good ways.
Yeah.
I don't know. It felt like a really lived in pair of performances.
I think maybe it opened in limited release in November. I don't know if that sounds right, but I really regret that we missed it, Josh, when it came out, because for me, it needs a solid 30-minute discussion on the show at minimum. I think it's that good.
And,
so.
and for people who haven't seen this movie, we just talked about Leo McCarey's Make Way for Tomorrow. That's one of the most wrenching portraits of an older couple, Beulah Bondi and Victor Moore in the film, and just how they're dealing with, you know, again, economic straits, sort of the disdain and disinterest of their immediate family. Mm-hmm. That's a really tough-minded movie for 1937, yeah. And it's stunning.
And those, all three of them, Make Way for Tomorrow, Tokyo Story, and Love is Strange, are sort of structured in such a way to where you get this incredible powerhouse ending. So the fact that we're wrecked by it, that's all baked
slow
in the
build,
baked
the slow
in the
build.
Pie.
Yeah.
All right, number six, Michael Phillips.
My number six is Listen Up, Philip, which Scott has already dealt with, and this is Alex Ross Perry's fantastically acidic film, and as you say, it's Philip Roth is certainly the model, the basis, everything in this film, but it's a Philip Roth adaptation with the difference in that it's not based on any Roth novel or short story. It's just simply kind of Rothian in its pursuits, and both characters played by Jason Schwartzman and Jonathan Pryce are very Philip Roth in sort of their bottomless ego, bottomless well of narcissism. And the film takes such a smart and funny and wry stance at all the misbehavior on view. I watched this film with an open mind. I was laughing half the time and just sort of like, because it is, of all the films this year that deal with artistic ego and this kind of, what price, success, all that stuff. So many of them, even films I like Birdman but Don't Love, they're very soft on the protagonist in the end. They're very kind of easy on him, and their flaws are about this big. This guy is hilariously lost up his own ass, and it's just I don't know. And Elizabeth Moss is.
Why were you looking at Josh when you said that?
I said I was no not at all. This was a transition, Adam. Okay,
accusing me of being Jason Schwartz.
But
I can't believe
Elizabeth Moss in this. I think what I love about this too, and you don't see very many films of any type where you get the central relationship between, in this case, Schwartzman and Elizabeth Moss, where it's a live-in, they're living together, and we meet her when she's long, long past figured out what she saw in this guy in the first place.
That detour is so crucial to the film for me.
Yeah, it's great, and I love it that it's just, absolutely, the film just sort of like makes a left turn, and suddenly we're with her for 20, 25, 30 minutes, and it feels utterly right, and if you really require, as a moviegoer, some sort of conventional empathy or sympathy with your protagonist, this really, I can't think of a worse film for you.
This film will hand you a paper with staples, essentially.
Yeah. But I just it's worth, I this for the minute the Schwartzman character goes to see his literary agent, and this guy sees Philip coming, and he just sort of starts stealing himself for another terrible encounter with the guy, and he just turns to his assistant and says, please don't haul my calls. And I just think that's, there's a million of those kind of lines in this film. It's a delight.
As with any punctual individual, Philip loathed when people ran late, which Mona typically was. By the time Mona made her way to Philip, he was in a state of rage and on the verge of storming out, a reaction he was known to often have towards the end of their two-year relationship. During the arguments that led to their breakup, Mona repeatedly emphasized Philip's short fuse and poor temper as key factors in no longer being capable of tolerating his company.
It's just crazy that you're late to me. It's just minutes I'm waiting, almost 30. It's an insult. Also, I have a really busy day, so now I have less than an hour. Probably not even have time to eat anything.
Maybe a grilled cheese for me.
I had it the other day. It's disgusting. So I ask you how you are, right? Things are good?
Yeah, that's the one line I have about that movie is like, how caustic a movie is if casting Eric Bogosian as the narrator is the least abrasive element in the movie.
That's a good point.
But are we on to my number six?
We are on to your number six.
My number six is Nuri Bilge Ceylan's new film, Winter Sleep, which opens this weekend in New York and opens in early January at the Music Box here in Chicago. And this is his, about 200-minute long Chekhov.
196. I watched it last night.
196.
Don't exaggerate, Scott.
It's a long movie is what I'm saying, but it's so riveting, and it's about this, the sort of tragedy of a jerk. I'm going to say a jerk. But the one line I quote, this is a justified quote, and I can't use the profanity here, but the line I come back to is like, if you meet a jerk in the morning, you've met a jerk. If you meet jerks all day, you're the jerk. In the show, it's a different word. It's not for wide public consumption, but you get the point. Here's a guy who he runs this mountaintop hotel in Anatolia. The people below, he's their debt collector. He's their landlord. He is in control of that town. He believes himself to be a wise, thoughtful, benevolent leader. Everyone around him believes otherwise. And and in a way, you know, it's not just about. It'd be one thing if it were about sort of the follies of a misanthrope, but it's not that. It really is a tragedy. It's a tragic disconnection between this guy and the people around him. And I think it's, you know, it almost has kind of a, you know, I'm sure it has very particular meaning in like Turkish politics that I don't necessarily get, but I think it has a more of a universal theme here about people who live in the ivory tower and really lack that capability of understanding and empathizing with other people's perspectives. And then, of course, you know, it being a film by Ceylan, it is harshly, starkly gorgeous and has a lot of very long scenes inside that are quite compelling and cinematic and not, you know, play-like at all.
Another pick of yours, Scott, that features some of my favorite performances of the year. I mean, Haluk Bilginer Haluk Bilginer, if that's how you pronounce it, but in the lead.
I'm not going to correct you, Jeff.
Since we're messing these up, I mm-hmm. might as well join in. But he, you know, he's just, I described him as this weary, self-proclaimed monarch who's trudging around this kingdom that he created, and he's the only one who believes in it. And he holds you for every one of those minutes for sure. And the other one I really liked was the sister, Demet Akbag, as the actress's name. And she doesn't get a ton of scenes, but they're such crucial insights into the psyche of the main character that she really turns the gears.
She does.
She gets very long scenes, and they're very great, introspective into what is behind the image he's trying to project.
That's a good way to put it. I think if you're at all interested in that period just before what's going to ruin that marriage, any marriage, it finally gets laid out on the table. These people, the couple at the center has been living in this sort of false place for so long, mm-hmm. where his self-satisfaction and kind of blind, you know, ego is kind of one thing, and his wife's just growing disdain, you know, and contempt for the guy. You know, it's not heavy-handed or obvious. I find the film, just like the Chekhov short stories it's loosely based on, it's all tragically funny. I don't know if it's a tragedy or if it's tragically funny, but I just find that it just feels utterly, it's one of my favorite Chekhov adaptations in existence, and maybe like Listen Up Philip, it wasn't really based on Philip Roth. It's not really based on Chekhov, but it captures the spirit so well that it's like a new benchmark for adaptation, I think.
All right, I'm up to my number six, and this film has my shot of the year in it. Talked about it in our Best of the Rest show. The director was also one of my 2014 discoveries, and the co-star, Agata Kulesza, gives one of my favorite supporting performances of the year. I'll allow Slate's Dana Stevens to announce the pick because she was an early champion of the film.
So after much agonizing among a few different movies, I finally settled on the movie that ravished me most upon viewing in 2014, which is Paweł Pawlikowski's Ida, which I think you guys have talked about on the show. It's a black and white, very short, 80-minute long, very simple, and to me, very profound film about a young nun in the early 1960s in Poland searching for the truth about her family. What made me choose Ida? Got to get into 30 seconds here. I would say it was the purity of the images, just the pure beauty of the film, the spareness of the script, and at the same time, the completeness of the characterizations of the young girl and her aunt. They're just such complete, wonderful characters. And then just somehow the rightness of every frame of this movie, every casting choice, every music cue. There's something about Ida that just feels so, so solid and compact and complete, like it was meant to be exactly what it is. And so that's why Paweł Pawlikowski's Ida is my choice for 2014. All right, thanks for a year in film spotting, guys.
When we did catch up with this, Adam, it was on our top five films of the year so far show. It made both of our lists at that time. For me, it was a combination of things. It was both the rigorous formalism, this black and white cinematography, the composition, the use of music, and the religious investigation that was so gripping, the way those were combined. So if you haven't seen Ida yet, it is on DVD now. I do have one more pitch. It's only 80 minutes, which, do you realize that's about half an Exodus? I'm measuring things in Exodus time
now. And a third of winter sleep.
There you go.
And it's 1/45th of The Hobbit 3. So
I think Exodus is actually longer.
Yeah,
it just felt the other way around.
Yeah, I feel like The Hobbit still hasn't ended. So,
well, my number six pick is a movie that really feels right at home in a conversation with Ida. Small little film called Interstellar.
Boy.
Director Christopher Nolan. And I did have to go to the well here and bust out a very wise man to give me some support, especially against the hater,
uh-huh.
Josh.
Yeah.
And this wise man wrote this, and it's a semi-spoiler alert here if you haven't caught up with Interstellar yet. It is hobbled by astronomy and physics seminars disguised as dialogue. But even with its vividly realized imaginings of journeys through a wormhole or its depiction of the largest tidal wave in the history of water, what I remembered first the following morning was this. Matthew McConaughey's character crying his eyes out as he watches years and years of backlog video messages left by his son back on Earth. Simple, elemental, human feeling. More directors should try it sometime. That great writer was Michael Phillips.
Yes, thank you.
You remember those words?
I was disappointed in your reading.
Well, you know.
I feel like there was a gap between...
That's not how you wrote
you've
it.
You've heard and participated in Massacre Theater.
Writers are very particular about the rhythm of
the rhythm of the
phrase.
I missed it. Okay, next time we'll rehearse. But I'm with you, Michael. Yes, you can talk about how great the effects are, the scale of the movie, and some of the acting performances. The human emotion is fundamentally what I remember most about Interstellar, and more than that, the humanity of the entire film. Josh, I tried to discuss this a little bit during our review, what really crystallized for me in Nolan's work in this film. In all of his films, this exploration of longing, of regret, and what speaks more to sort of this sense of human futility than the inability to correct a past mistake, to go back in time and undo a past trauma. You simply can't do it. The universe is uncaring and the rules of the universe don't allow it. And his characters somehow in all these films, they still fight anyway. They fight against that uncaring universe. And yes, of course, we've seen those emails come in, Josh, more people to your defense, people claiming how laughable some of the dialogue
is. They're starting to trickle in.
For those of you who think some of the lines are a little too corny or whatever, I say get over your smug selves. Watch the movie again. Go along for the ride with Matthew McConaughey and company. It's my number 6.
That is a good scene. Michael wrote about good enough to put a film on a top 10 list. I don't know. Scott, can I get any support from you in Interstellar being not quite the mind-blowing experience?
I liked it, but it's not on my list.
Okay. All right.
Same. But I mean, at least it made its own set of nutty mistakes in addition to everything it does right. You know, it just doesn't, at least Nolan is following his own playbook, and it's not just like the last playbook he went
but
for.
But this is a little bit the ambition argument again we got into last time,
and
when
you
we
should
did
get
feedback
some credit
is,
for ambition.
I know, but there's something wrong when you're talking so much about how the movie's ambitious.
I haven't.
You haven't.
No.
You haven't.
Okay. That is part one of our top 10 films of the year countdown. We are going to get to our top 5 films of the year in part 2 of the show. And also, I think I'm going to try to make the guys stick around a little bit and share their picks for worst films of the year. We'll do that just in bonus content, though. You can get that bonus content if you have the Film Spotting app for iTunes, Android, or Windows 8 phone. You can go to filmspotting.net and click on apps to get more information. Of course, we always want your feedback. Send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. Or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and @Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in limited release, opening in Chicago this week, and a few different movies. The one we're going to highlight, though, is a movie that made Josh's 10 through 6. That is The Babadook, directed by Jennifer Kent. Definitely a movie recommended, it sounds like, by all 4 of us.
Yes.
To see it.
Yes,
get a chance.
And to see it on the big screen, too.
An audience, right? I mean, a horror film with an audience who's into it, that's a great opportunity.
Best horror film I've seen since The Conjuring, easily.
Wow. Playing at the Music Box here in Chicago. Out in wide release, Annie, Josh, Gwenjane Wallace, you'll be right there in line, right?
Yeah, she looks to be doing something a little bit different
than Beast of the Southern Wild from
the commercials that I saw.
Well, as I already lamented on a previous show, I will be there with my children at Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb. I'm not going to be able to avoid that one. That's also opening.
I was going to ask you if this was a gun to your head situation.
Pretty
here.
Much.
Annie or Night of the Museum 3, whatever it is.
You're going to
Night of the Museum.
Trying to be a good father, going to put the phone down for 90 minutes or so. We'll see how that works out.
I know you're going to be peeking.
Next week, it will be, as we said, part 2 of the top 10 films of 2014. Michael and Scott are going to be here all week, I think, just basically chained to the desk. Josh, your wife brought some goodies. Yeah, they'll be fine.
We feed them.
They'll be fine. So, guys, thank you.
Can you clothe us?
I don't know about that.
You are such a diva, Michael Phillips.
As always, your insights were greatly appreciated. Is there anything out there our listeners can look forward to reading from you this week? Anything you want to promote?
You know, my own top 10 with 10 or 20 more behind it at chicagotribune.com/movies.
Yeah, and this week was all about year-end stuff. We have best films that made under $100,000 at the box office, and we have acting, actress. We have the big year-end film piece. And then as a little bonus thing, I wrote a very long, like 3,000-word 1 year later piece about The Wolf of Wall Street.
Nice.
So to really kind of do a deep dive into
I'm
that.
I'm going to make Josh read that like Alex in A Clockwork Orange.
I'm getting my homework.
Thank you, guys. Thank
Film
you.
Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week, some of the year's best film scores. They were chosen by friend of the show, Sam Smith. Thanks, Sam, for putting that together. We always appreciate it. You can learn more about Sam at samsmith.blogspot.com. That's SAMSMYTH. We'll also post the full list of Sam's score picks over at filmspotting.net when part two goes up next week. Until then, for Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.